This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Sometimes historic events suck. But what shouldn't suck is learning about history. I do that through storytelling. History That Doesn't Suck is a chart-topping history podcast created by me, Professor Greg Jackson. Listen to History That Doesn't Suck on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, joining me right now is the great play-by-play voice of the Washington Capitals on Monumental Sports for many, many years now, Joe Beninati, joining us at Joe BPXP on X on Twitter. To follow Joe. By the way, Joe does everything well, and I actually was listening to Joe call the Maryland-Ohio State lacrosse Big Ten title the other night. You get around. That was a pretty good game. Was Maryland the one seed, or was Ohio State the one seed?
Ohio State's the one seed in the Big Ten, Kevin, but Maryland had beaten seven top 10 ranked teams during the regular season total.
Yeah.
So when it came time for NCAA tournament seeding, Maryland was actually a higher seed than Ohio State, the team that just beat their breaks off in the Big Ten championship game. But Maryland had beaten Ohio State 3 weeks prior. So I think John Tillman's team is terrific. Nick Myers' team in Columbus, Ohio is really damn good too. I wouldn't be surprised if you had a couple of Big Ten teams in that NCAA championship weekend, depending upon how the brackets square out. I'm not sure how that lines up, but yeah, really good game. And I you know me, it's a love for me to do that sport. Yeah. It's one that I grew up with.
You played it, and were good at it. And I'm looking at the bracket, actually. This was not what I intended to talk to you about. But I do know, I do know that there are people listening that are very much into this. In fact, I know some of the kids on the Maryland team because I know the families very well. Maryland is the overall two seed. Cornell's one, Princeton's yep. three, and Ohio State's four. Maryland and Ohio State are on opposite sides of the bracket. Maryland would play Robert Morris Air Force and then Duke Georgetown to get yep. to, it would appear, the Final Four. So
I just think when Maryland has a week to prepare for teams, that coaching staff, that head coach in particular, John Tillman, and the players, the way they respond to him, they get it done. I'll throw this quick aside at you, Kevin. During the semifinal win for Maryland, we interviewed Logan McNaney postgame. And afterwards, the producer's in my ear, okay, just quick thanks and cold. So I thank him, congratulate him, and he's like, yeah, go Caps.
That's awesome. Well, he knew, he obviously knew who he was being interviewed by.
Oh, yeah.
Now, do you call any of these games in the tournament or not?
No, I wish. It's the same issue with regard to me and ESPN, where I would love to be involved. They know I want to be involved, but there are people on contracts who need to get their events. So this is a lonely part for me. I lonely watch the NCAA tournament unfold, and in the same way I'm sitting in the arena last night watching the Stanley Cup playoffs unfold. It's the best time of the year, but it's the toughest time of the year for me.
All right, let's get to why I reached out to you. So, in brief, you know me. I don't know the sport like I, you know, think that I know other sports. But last night, I think anybody could have identified, if they're a sports fan, a one-sided game. That the final score, not even close to reflecting how much Carolina dominated. Fair or not?
Oh, completely. And don't sell yourself short. You know this sport. Yeah, that game was, and I said it, it was one of the most lopsided 1-1 games I've ever seen in a long, long time. Logan was terrific, and that's exactly what I think Caps fans should hold their heads high, knowing that this, in my opinion, was going to be a long series, and if it's going to be, Logan's going to need to play like that. But that was just about as close to a perfectly executed road playoff game as you can get. Both of those teams were on relatively equal rest. It should come as no surprise to Washington what Carolina wants to do, but their execution of it was matter-of-factly close to perfect last night. And they do what they do. Washington has a very similar schematic approach to the game, so there's no surprises at all between these two squads. It was simply that Carolina executed at an incredibly high level. Logan kept them close. And you're going to hear all the metrics about shot volume and shots attempted and goals above expected, all this good stuff. It comes down to, for Washington's sake, it's always been a matter of quality versus quantity. Carolina and Brind'Amour, they favor quantity. They want to throw everything they can at the other team's goalie. I think Washington waits for the better scoring chances. And if this series plays out the way we saw last night, the Caps are going to have to be incredibly efficient, very economic, because they're not going to get very many chances. When they do, they have to bury them.
So that's perfect segue into what I wanted to get to, because, you know, they were, in terms of shots on goal, 33-14 Carolina, but the shot attempts, 94-34. Everybody has explained, including going into the series, because I had John Walton on the show on radio yesterday, that this is what Carolina does. It's about volume of shots. What I haven't had necessarily explained well, but I bet you will, is, you know, the quality of chances, you know, the better scoring chances isn't necessarily Carolina's MO. It's about attempts, and 60 more attempts is pretty incredibly one-sided. But my question to you is, does it make kind of the counterattack, the counterpunch, more likely when a team is that aggressive, and as long as they're not getting consistent high quality chances, is it a strategy that could pay off for the Caps in the form of like what Ryan Leonard had late, you know, or two on ones in sort of the counter, you know, punch ability off of the way Carolina's playing?
Everybody knows their philosophy. They are constantly stressing you. And the question is, can you find, can you expose their vulnerabilities? It's in football, I'm going to zero blitz you to death. Okay, you can do that, and you'll get home, and you'll get to the quarterback, but you are going to leave yourself exposed to some one-on-ones.
Right.
And in that instance, that's where the counterpunch, that's the countermeasure. The 90 attempts, 90-plus shot attempts, to me, speaks more than anything to a stat that was season-long with Carolina. Kevin, nobody spends more time in the offensive zone than Carolina. They get the puck in deep very well. They forecheck the bejesus out of you. They force turnover after turnover. The thing that Caps fans do not want to hear, Sean McDonough and Ray Ferraro, if they remain on the series, I'm not sure if they're there tomorrow, but you don't want to hear Sean and Ray talking about, oh, there's another almost clear. They almost got it out. No. Every chance the Caps tomorrow night get to get the puck out of the zone, it has to get out. If it doesn't, it just turns into these waves and waves of momentum,
right,
shift after shift. Spencer Carberry put it to us perfectly in the lead-up to this series. He's like, you cannot let one strong Carolina shift of momentum turn into two, three, four different changes of personnel where they are just jamming it at you. And that's what they love to do. That is their MO. They will not stop. They are relentless. It starts from the head coach, and the players buy in 100%.
Yeah, I mean, the expression, the ice was tilted. I mean, it was at 180 degrees last night, it felt like. But, yep. You know, back to the question I asked, what I'm getting at is the strategy to even out the tilting of the ice, or is it to create more opportunities from their over-aggressiveness on the counter?
A little bit of both. And honestly, Kevin, what Carolina does really well, Washington does really well. That's Washington's strength normally, is get the puck deep, get it beyond the defenders for Carolina, force them back, force them into panic situations, hit, forecheck, use your strength, use that heavy brand of play that the Caps are known for, force turnovers, create off those turnovers, score goals. What the Caps do is what the Canes do. Now, who gets to execute it better? And for some reason last night, Washington's passing game, which has been very good of late, Washington's breakout game, getting the puck from the defensive zone out into neutral, out into offense, that's called breaking out. The Caps have been breaking out so very well all season long. Carolina has a way of neutralizing those skills. Washington will try to do the same thing and try to put that onto Carolina's plate. Here's the difference last night. The thing that stood out to me, and it's amazing, I've said this a time or two, when I'm calling a game is one thing. When I'm watching as a spectator, as an interested pre- and post-game show analyst, host, or whatever I am, I see things differently. And the first thing that I noticed last night, and this is not to throw shade on Montreal, Carolina's defenders, their back six,
right,
are so much better,
right,
than Montreal.
Yes.
And that's where they expose you. Those guys crash down the wall. They don't let you get out of your own zone, so the puck's always near Logan. They're pinching, they're crashing, it's relentless. And oh, by the way, those defenders are really good at it. Lots of teams try to do it. Carolina executes it, and it starts with a 40-year-old gentleman who, you know, you sit there and go, wow, he can't be that effective. Brent Burns is still effective. Jacob Slavin may be the best defensive defenseman in all the NHL. Goss Despair, with his deception and all at the point on their power play, running offensive sets. Dmitry Orlov, who we've known here for a dozen years, their defense is really good. And that's what stood out to me. Like, whoa, this is a major leap from Montreal to Carolina. There's a reason why Carolina was second best in the Metro to Washington, and really good and highly thought of and thought by many to be even the favorite in this series. I didn't think so, but I got this suspicion that the Caps win a long series, and that's going to be, if they're going to do that, if they're going to live up to what I think they can do, they're going to have to get it done tomorrow.
Yeah, you mentioned something that I was going to ask you about, because one of the things you pointed out to me early in the Montreal series when I had you on radio is that the Caps, it's very obvious, they're just bigger and stronger. And they did not appear to be that last night at all. That struck me. And Carolina defensively, when the Caps were even in the offensive zone, they were knocking pucks away. They were turning them over. And then I thought the passing, Carolina seemed, now maybe the Caps were just off last night, but the passing, taking that puck into the offensive zone, was so crisp for Carolina and so sloppy for the Caps, I thought. Did you feel the same
argument,
way?
No argument at all. They weren't sharp. Washington was not sharp. Carolina was. And as that game unfolded, the more and more you watched it, you're like, how is this 1-0 Washington?
Exactly.
And you go to the goal crease. Logan was good last night, Kevin. He didn't have to be extraordinarily
true,
good, but he was very good last night. And if, you know, there were a bunch of posts, there were some very, very good stops by LT, that easily could have been 4-0, 5-0 the other way around. But it was right there for you to steal. And such a shame to not be able to get that one across the finish line when it looked like you might be able to steal it. You were badly outplayed, and yet you still had it on your stick. And I'm not going to things happen with plays off the boards, Protas jamming Alexiev on that clearing effort. It winds up on Stan Coven's stick.
Yeah.
That's trouble. But there, it could have been settled long, long before that. The thing that amazes me, or not surprises me, Kevin, it's just these two teams want to do the same thing. And one team last night did it at incredibly fast, accurate speeds, and the other team didn't.
Was the goal Logan Thompson gave up in overtime a soft goal, as they say?
No, not to me. I think screened, yes. The release was quick. I don't know that he saw it cleanly. Has he made that save before? Yes. So I can't pin that on him. Nobody really saw the flight very well. And this is one of the reasons why Carolina preaches the game they preach. Every shot's a good shot. Every shot on goal has a chance to end up as a deflection, going off of somebody's butt, and the goalie can't see it. So why not take it? And if Jacob Slavin, who's not a real goal scorer in any stretch, has a wide open shot from a long range, just take it. And then Brendan Moore's philosophy is take it and then crash that net, look for rebounds, force Washington's defenders to panic. They didn't have to. It went in clean. To me, that's just all part and parcel of what Carolina does. And for the first 40 minutes or so, one thing I mentioned in our pregame coverage on Monumental Sports Network was, for Logan Thompson, the puck needs to stick to him tonight. It can't be, he's got to have good rebound control. For 40 minutes, clean. It was like he was a sponge. The glove was good, really good. And if you have to take stoppages and take defensive zone faceoffs, do it. Rather than what Carolina wants is keep throwing at the cage. Somebody will screw it up. It'll bounce on our tape. We'll bag goals that way. No, it wasn't there. And that's why it was a shutout performance for a long, long time. There's nothing that Carolina did offensively last night that surprises me or overly concerns me. Yes. Are they speedy? Absolutely. Do they pass the puck well? Yeah. You didn't see the best of their power play last night. You can't take penalties against them tomorrow or any other game in this series. But if it was disappointing to see the 5-on-5 play tilt so much in Carolina's favor, because I think that's one of Washington's strengths.
You know, the game winner was, I thought, an odd reaction. I think Staal was the one that was right there. And I think they had just assumed that Logan Thompson had swallowed it up like he had almost everything all night long.
You know, there was,
and they didn't see it. It was almost a delayed reaction. Yeah.
That's the thing, Kevin. It's the cage sometimes, those beanbags at the bottom. There was no net ripple. It got stuck in there. It goes in. It's like a thud. You know, you're not seeing a big – the net doesn't flare and bulge. And but they knew it was through, and it just squirts through his pad, underneath his pad. And have we seen him make that save? Sure, but I don't think he tracked it at all with the screen and the amount of bodies that were in front of him.
It was a bad ending for Washington, but, man, there is something so dramatic about sudden death overtime in the NHL playoffs. So, you know, the NBA playoffs, these games are like, you know, individual entities. I mean, game two can look completely different than game one after adjustments. You've already talked about some of them for Spencer Carberry, but is this sport one in which what we saw last night, the opposite might occur tomorrow night?
Sure. I would imagine the Caps are in meeting rooms and in film rooms and on the practice sheet and going to be talking about it in independent group chats and however they meet for the rest of the day and for tomorrow morning and in the subsequent minutes leading up to game two about ways to counteract what Carolina does. And they saw it in the flesh. They saw it twice in April, late in the regular season.
Right.
So it shouldn't have been foreign to them. There's no surprises between these two teams. And schematically, people will sit there and go, geez, you know, they really behave alike. It's just a matter of who executes the best. So how do you get Carolina's forecheck off balance? How do you support the Washington defenders? How do you help Carlson and Chychrun and Sandin and Roy and Alexiev and Van Riemsdyk? How do you help them get out of the zone cleaner, better? The thing you want to look for, to me, and I'm not an analyst, I'm just a play-by-play person pretending to be an analyst.
No,
but
you're
to me, tomorrow night, look for five Caps in the picture everywhere. And that means the wings in the defensive zone, not just the center getting deep to help, but I think the wings will come further down. You'll have a more connected-looking group trying to leave the zone because Carolina is crashing and taking the boards away and forcing you to the middle and forcing you into these traps. So if you can shorten the distance of that first pass, make it quick, it's got to be accurate, and it forces them to back off a little bit, then all of a sudden you can breathe. And then you get to neutral zone, you dump it. It becomes like a punting game, Kevin. You want to change the field. You want to flip the field all the time on Carolina.
Right.
If they do it to you,
yeah,
and they put it inside your five-yard line all the time,
yeah,
you want the ability to cough and corner them. You got to get out of the zone. So whatever it is that they can do, and again, the analysts and the head coaches and the assistant coaches, more importantly, and the players, they'll execute on what will help them get out better, cleaner. If you have to flip it and just, you know, literally punt the puck out of your zone, you can do that from time to time too, but you got to get it out. They tried that a couple of times last night and never got it out, so it just keeps coming right back at you. You have to get it out, and I think it's more of a five-man unit, deeper support, move as an entity through neutral zone, dump it in, and then do what they do to you. You forecheck them, and that's what we like to do. That's what the Caps like to do when they're playing well. That's why I keep saying these teams, there are times when they're mirror images of each other. Carolina's faster, top to bottom, yes, but Washington is normally a better passing team. And something I've learned since I was in youth hockey, the puck moves faster than any man. If they move the puck well, pass the puck well, they can overcome all this pressure.
Joe B. reads the room better than anybody with all of these football analogies on the show today. I still think the zero coverage blitz is the better of the two football analogies that you've given us today. All right, I'll finish with this. Concern level 0 to 5. 0, no concern at all. 5, the Caps are in big trouble in this series. Where are you?
3. You have to get tomorrow night. I don't really like the chances of beating Carolina 4 out of 5, and especially with 3 of those games being in Raleigh, where, oh, by the way, they won 31 times, I think. They were one of the top, if not the top, home ice team, toughest team to beat right there, I want to say, with Los Angeles. I don't have numbers in front of me. No, you need to get it done tomorrow, so your concern level can't be a 0. I think it's a little bit more than half, so I'll go to 3. And I just believe so much in this team, Kevin. They rarely, and I'm going to knock on wood as I say this, they rarely throw 2 clunkers in a row. And now where you're considering 8 months of really hard work on the line, all the high stakes and the high rewards and all the pressure, it's all on the line now. In that game tomorrow, they need to perform better and level the series and then go down there and figure out how to beat them once. And then you become, you know, then you can become part of a best of 3 where you have 2 of them in D.C. That's got to be your mindset now. First and foremost, 1 at a time, game 2, and remedying the situation from last night. No Cap's going to look in the mirror today and say, geez, we were good last night. They weren't. Logan was.
Yeah.
But it was off. It was just an off performance, and I'm going to chalk it up to that until I see Carolina execute that well again. If they do that well again, then they're going to make things awfully difficult.
You know, I actually have one more question, because I've asked you a lot about, you know, pressure on the Caps in the postseason, and, you know, getting out of the Montreal series was huge because they hadn't gotten out of the first round since 2018. You know, Carolina has been a threat in the Eastern Conference postseason for several years in a row now under their current coach, Rod Brind'Amour. Is there pressure on Carolina to go deep this year? Like, are there fans like, we can't go out in the second round again? They've been to some conference finals, but is there a lot of pressure kind of building on them?
Sure. I want to say they've been out in the second round 3 of the last 4.
Yeah.
Yeah, they want to go deeper. They have a nucleus of players there who are just about in their prime. And they have some young guns that are going to come up and make them very, very good for a long time moving forward. But yeah, I think any of the 8 teams that are left in the Stanley Cup playoffs are good enough to win it all. I really do. Those 4 teams out west are seriously good. And I don't think there's a weak link in the East at all. You're down to four outstanding teams in the East. Two of them are in this series. One of them needs to behave better tomorrow night. And I know they're capable of it, and I know they're going to be extremely well coached to do it. Let's see how quickly they can turn the tables. You have to flip it, because one team was able to do and execute to its identity far better than the other. And I don't think these two teams are that far apart. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But I think Washington is way better than what they showed last night. I love the heart and the hustle and the block shots that they were. There was a lot of sacrifice there. It had to be. You never had the puck. You have to be able to get out of your own zone tomorrow, and you have to put them under that pressure pack situation. You've done it before. They can do it again. They'll do it tomorrow.
Joe Beninati, everybody, always the best. Really missing you and Locker and Allen and all the guys. Hope Locker's doing well. Really appreciate this. Hopefully we have a chance to do it again before the next series or during the next series. Thanks, Joe.
My pleasure, Kev. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Joe Beninati, that was his discussion with me yesterday on my podcast. Joe's always great. The Caps are big underdogs tonight, minus 175 Carolina tonight, and they are now a minus 400 favorite to win the series. Tonight can shift a lot of those odds if the Caps can get a win. Ovechkin just one shot on goal in the opener, probably needs more than that tonight. There's my hockey input for the day. Joe's the best. Love hearing his thoughts on the sport. Big one tonight, 7 o'clock on our sister station, 106.7 The Fan. When we come back, an interesting poll just released on how D.C. residents feel about a new stadium on the RFK site. We'll talk about that when we come back. In addition to another pass rushing name is out there linked to Washington. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, theteam980.com. You can download the Odyssey app, listen to us whenever, wherever you want. You can watch us, the show now being streamed on the Team 980 YouTube page. Hit the subscribe button, hit the like button for us if you end up consuming the show that way. The words might change the next time they're back in RFK, but that was the final time Hail to the Redskins was played at RFK Stadium back in December of 1996. The plans are to move back to RFK. What is pending is D.C. City Council approval. 7 votes required. We had Phil Mendelson, the D.C. City Council chair, on the show on Friday. He believes, with more information, that he and the city council can cut a better deal with the team than the mayor came up with. We shall see. Interesting polling news from the Washington Post just a little while ago. They released the results of a poll that they conducted, a Washington Post Schar School poll. The Schar School is the George Mason, arm of their school. They polled 651 D.C. residents. Right, these are residents of the District of Columbia asking the question, would you favor or oppose the district government using about $850 million in city funds to help finance development for a new football stadium for the Washington Commanders, where RFK Stadium now stands in D.C.? 55% favor it. A majority of D.C. residents polled favor a stadium at the RFK site. 39% opposed it, 6% had no opinion or skipped the question as part of, I'm sure, several questions they had on this poll slash survey. Now, a couple of things. Number one, $850 million is not the number. The poll question was asked when the number appeared to be $850 million, and which would be the city's cost for the new property and the new development of the RFK site. We know now that it will be north of $1 billion. But the question was asked when it was still thought to be $850 million. Obviously, if the Post had the $1 billion figure, they would have used that. I do wonder, because there is a big difference, maybe not in the amount, but in the appearance, the presentation of the dollar amount, if the question were asked, would you favor or oppose the district government using about $1.1 billion in city funds to help finance development of a new football stadium at RFK. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But I bet the numbers might be a little bit different, but maybe still a majority, maybe slightly less, although it's barely a majority. But still, 55% in a city where typically taxpayers are not for, you know, giving money, taxpayer money, to billionaire owners to help them build their stadiums, is a number that's encouraging and a number that could be influencing to city council members. Interestingly, part of the story that the Post put out there is that when city residents were polled about the Capital One $500 million investment to keep Capital One or to renovate Capital One, 64% were in favor of that. Now, it's less money. It was also an arena that already existed there. There was a clear understanding, I think, of D.C. residents on what Capital One, you know, not being there and what that area might end up looking like, that there was concern there. We're talking about an entity that currently does not exist in D.C. But still, I think 55%, even though I think $850 million, which is not the number, it'll be more like $1.1 billion, unless, of course, the city council's able to negotiate with the mayor or without the mayor, with the team directly or with, indirectly, a better deal and less of an expenditure. But, you know, it's still, I think, a favorable result. And doesn't necessarily surprise me. I think most people in the city recognize what this kind of a stadium would do and what the property, what that 175 acres or whatever it is, it's close to that, would look like beyond just the vertical stadium structure. Because we know what it looks like now. You know, not everybody knows what it looks like now. If you don't come into D.C., if you don't live in D.C. and you haven't driven down to that part of the city, it's not attractive. And you're only a couple of blocks away from very attractive. So it'd be nice to see that area resuscitated. And I think the stadium and the stadium project would do that. Of course, there are people that would argue there are plenty of things you could do that would not include a stadium that would make that area look great and make it economically viable. But anyway, so those were the results of the Post poll just put out earlier this morning. Also, football team related, Jeffrey Chihida, I think is how you pronounce his name, a writer for CBSSports.com, took the remaining NFL free agents and, you know, came up with a best fit for a team. And for Washington, he wrote that Matthew Judon, who played in Atlanta last year, played in New England before that, would be a good fit for Washington. He writes, Washington GM Adam Peters has been aggressive in each of the past two seasons when it comes to free agency. That's not necessarily true. They've signed a lot of players. They haven't been overly aggressive, you know, in free agency. Lots of players, lots of one-year deals, you know, a multi-year deal this year with Javon Kinlaw. Couple of big trades, that's for sure. Tunsil and Lattimore in the midst of the season, and obviously Deebo Samuel. But anyway, he writes, the one thing he still needs to find for this team is more help in pressuring opposing passers. The team leader in sacks from 2024, Dante Fowler Jr., returned to Dallas in this offseason, and Peters didn't take any edge rushers in the draft. That leaves Judon as an intriguing option for a team that wants to make another power move in the NFC after reaching last year's championship game. He has flaws. He turns 33 in August and only amassed 5.5 sacks in his one season with the Falcons last But he also fits what Peters has been finding in free agency the last couple of years. The Commanders received valuable contributions from older veterans like Bobby Wagner and Zach Ertz in 2024. If Judon can give them a little boost in the pass rush, he would be just as beneficial to Washington's hopes of reaching the Super Bowl. So, you know, we've talked about some of the available, you know, pass rushers out there. Za'Darius Smith is out there. He actually put Za'Darius Smith in Detroit. You know, you do still have the, you know, Trey Hutchinson situation in Cincinnati that has not been resolved yet. But Matthew Judon's interesting because Matthew Judon did not have a good season last year. But to be fair, Atlanta's defense for much of the year was terrible. It was a bad defense. Even when they were building up a really good record by the midway point in the season and had like a two-game lead in the NFC South, they were doing it with offense. They weren't doing it with defense. They were a bad defensive team. They got better as the season went along, but it just was... There just was something systemically wrong watching Atlanta play defense last year. They were just off. And Matthew Judon did not look good. He was part of it looking off. There's another aspect to Judon's game. Judon has played most of his career with teams that play base 3-4 defenses. So, you know, I don't know what that means. You know, can he play with his hand in the dirt as a defensive end, as an edge? Would he have to be kind of a linebacker? Would he have to be in a two-point stance? But Atlanta and New England, most recently, base 3-4 defenses when he was there. I don't know if that's as much of a factor anymore. We don't see that nearly as much. Teams take it into consideration, but I don't know if that's something that you'd mark him off for. Now, Matthew Judon is 33 years old, and he's coming off a season in which he did not really light it up for Atlanta on what was a bad defense for much of the year. 2023, he was hurt. But let's not forget that in 2021 and 2022, this dude had 28 sacks in two seasons. 12.5 for New England in 2021, 15.5 in 2022. He was in that NFL top 100 players vote in, you know, heading into the 2023 season. He was voted as the 33rd best overall player in the league. In the league. He was dominant as a pass rusher in New England before he, I think it was a bicep injury in 2023 early in the season, and he missed the remainder of the year. Who knows? Maybe he was still feeling the effects of that last year in Atlanta. He did not play well in Atlanta last year. Just didn't. But the team didn't play well. They played better late. We saw it, you know, at the end of the season against Washington. They were a better defensive team, even though Washington put up 30 in overtime against them. I don't know. I mean, that would be, you know, just like I felt about some other players that have had recent injury issues. Not that Judon had one last year. Nick Chubb did. By the way, he put Nick Chubb in Houston. Man, Mixon and Chubb. God, that's where I would look. I would definitely, on J.K. Dobbins and Nick Chubb, at least figure out whether or not they're healthy enough, because they can be had for a song right now. These are 1 year, $4-5 million deals with, you know, maybe incentives that build it up to $7 or $8 million because of the injuries. Dobbins is much younger. Chubb, I think, is just, when he's healthy, better. Asante Samuel's still out there, but, you know, I think they have hopes now for Trey Amos, you know, a corner. Anyway, Judon, a name to consider, along with Za'Darius Smith, along with Hutchinson, until that thing gets resolved. This isn't over yet, their roster construction. This will head right up until training camp and maybe even get tweaked a little bit as the preseason goes along. A preseason which we will know more about when the NFL schedule comes out a week from yesterday. My mock schedule, for those of you who have asked, I will give you my season opener on tomorrow's show at 11 a.m., and then on Monday, I'll have the entirety of my annual ridiculous Washington mock schedule. But yeah, you'll get the preseason game shortly after you get the entire NFL schedule. God, this time next week, we will be talking about a lot of late nights that are scheduled for 2025. A lot of primetime games. I bet you no less than five. When we come back, Tom Brady weighed in on Shedeur Sanders' fall and why the Raiders didn't select Shedeur Sanders, especially given that Brady had a relationship with Shedeur and Dion heading into the draft. That's next, 12 o'clock, Cody Benjamin with his quarterback NFL power rankings list. Jaden, very high on that list.
All right, last night the Boston Celtics blew another 20-point lead to the New York Knicks just to lose 91-90. They go down 2-0 in the series, head into the Garden. That is sure to be jumping. Speaking of blown leads, the Washington Nationals get another one. They were up 3-0, heading into the sixth. Michael Soroka loads the bases and gives up three RBIs to tie the game. Jorge Lopez enters in relief to give up two more runs. And Andrew Chafin finishes off with three more runs and ending the inning to put the Nats down 8-3. Game ends 8-6. Nats have the Cardinals coming to town. They will play tomorrow. Nats on deck with Charlie and Dave at 6:15 on 106.7 The Fan. That is tomorrow. Tonight on The Fan, the Washington Capitals will take on the Carolina Hurricanes in Game 2. Spencer Carberry has said to expect lineup changes following a dreadful performance in Game 1. And it looks like Ryan Leonard is going to be scratched tonight. He got extra work after practice today, and Taylor Radish came off with the extra skaters. This update is sponsored by the Team 980 YouTube page. Just open the app, type in the Team 980, and hit subscribe. Kevin Sheehan is live from 10 to 1, and Craig Hoffman from 4 to 7. Don't forget to like the stream and turn on notifications to stay up to date on all things DC sports. And that's what's trending.
Elephant in the room, Shedeur Sanders. What happened, Tom? Why did he go so late in the draft?
It's a good question. I wasn't a part of any evaluation process or to
Skip Bayless says otherwise.
No. Well, everyone's got that's the problem with media, is everyone can just say whatever the they want. I actually texted Shedeur because I know him very well. And I said, dude, like, whatever happens, wherever you go, like, that's your first day. Day two matters more than the draft. I was 199.
Yeah.
So who could speak on it better than me? Like, what that really means. Yeah. Use it as motivation. You're going to get your chances. Go take advantage of it.
It was Tom Brady on a podcast with Logan Paul and Mike Malak. Saying, I think the headline there was that he was not involved in the evaluation for the Raiders. Brady's an owner of Shedeur Sanders, which can't possibly be true, actually. I know that he pushed back on it. Mark Davis, the owner of the Raiders, said early on, Brady will have, quote, a huge voice, closed quote, when it comes to picking the quarterback. Brady also admitted that he was involved in the evaluation of their sixth round pick, quarterback Cam Miller from North Dakota State. There's a relationship that Tom Brady had with Shedeur Sanders. He had become a bit of a mentor to Shedeur Sanders and, you know, a friend of Dion's, etc. Of course he was involved in the evaluation of Shedeur Sanders and clearly did not, advise otherwise. Now, it's also fair to say, as we talked about during the draft last week and afterwards, that if you don't see Shedeur Sanders as a first-round talent and you see him more as a backup quarterback or maybe a low-end starter, is the juice worth it? Is it worth it having all of the attention that will come with him when you just signed Geno Smith in the offseason to be your starting quarterback? It's one thing to take a quarterback in the sixth round. You know, Brady could have answered it honestly, because I think there's some truth with all of the teams that passed on Shedeur Sanders. They didn't have him evaluated as a first rounder, and they didn't see it being worthwhile to bring him in as a guy that would be a backup quarterback in the NFL. But it such great advice from Brady. This draft night is so wildly overrated from every aspect. Doesn't mean we love it any less. Doesn't mean that it's any less entertaining. But just like with anything, this isn't the end. It's the beginning. Now, for a lot of players, I understand it from the economic, backgrounds they come from. The first round or second round paychecks, are life-changing for sure. But the real opportunity has just begun. the real, you know, opportunity is now to go out and make something of this, to get to a second contract, a third contract, a fourth contract, etc. And Brady's advice to Shadur, let's hope he accepts it, is right. Nothing that happened on draft weekend will matter once you show up for day two or day one of actually, you know, being in a locker room, learning a playbook, you know, and growing in that role. But there's no chance, right, that Brady wasn't involved in the evaluation. He was involved in the evaluation of the quarterback that they took in the sixth round. He apparently loves this kid, Cam Miller from North Dakota State. Let's keep an eye on him. Up next, we will talk with Cody Benjamin from CBSSports.com. He wrote a column yesterday ranking the quarterbacks in the NFL. Kevin Sheehan Show, Team 980 and the Team980.com.